This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In VPR's 2014 series, Choosing Vermont, Voices of the State's Young Professionals, people from across the state shared their thoughts on living in or leaving Vermont. One of the people we heard from was Ben Bonaccio of Burlington.
It's really tricky. The cost of living is exorbitant compared to some other comparable places. And so that, you know, I mean, I love being here, but that's definitely a struggle. And if we could have a better vacancy rate, better housing options, more affordable housing options, I think that would draw a lot more young people to the area and keep a lot more young people here.
The cost of living is often pointed out by politicians and residents as one of the major problems with Vermont. A recent Castleton Polling Institute survey reports that 33% of respondents pointed to the economy, jobs, and the cost of living as the most pressing issue facing the state. But what does it actually mean when people say the cost of living is too high? What's driving that cost up? And are there benefits to a relatively higher cost of living than other states, like quality of life? We're going to explore the statistics and the feelings today on the show, and I'm joined now by Jane Kolodinsky, chair of UVM's Department of Community Development and Applied Economics. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
And by Peter Matthews, chair of the Economics Department at Middlebury College. Peter Matthews, nice to have you here.
Delight to be here.
Peter Matthews, what traditionally goes into factoring the cost of living in a place?
Well, I think there are a couple of ways to think about this. One way of thinking about this is to ask yourself, what are the basic needs that a household needs to provide for itself in order to enjoy not an exorbitant life, not a luxurious life, but a comfortable life? And I'd invite listeners to go through the exercise of asking themselves what exactly those things are. And when you come up with that list, the numbers are, frankly, surprising. So the very first person you had quoted, Ben, noted that the cost of housing in Burlington is incredibly high, and that makes Burlington a quite expensive place relative to other places in New England.
So cost of living, you just mentioned housing is an important one. Groceries are another. Transportation
right.
costs are often factored in. Utilities. We've been looking at statistics compiled by the Missouri Economic Research and Information Center. They compile all these statistics, and they also include miscellaneous. And they found that Vermont has the 10th highest cost of living in the country, and it's particularly high in transportation costs. For comparison and for a little bit of context, the most expensive states in the country to live in, according to these statistics and these factors, are Alaska and Hawaii, Washington, D.C., and then the West Coast and the Northeast states. Pretty much all of the states in the interior of the country are right around the average cost of living or lower. But the idea that Vermont is in the top 10 and that it's really high in transportation costs, Jane Kolodinsky, I'm guessing that's not a surprise to you.
No, it's not a surprise to me. We are a rural state, and you have to get from one place to the other. And in addition, we're a northern rural state, which means your transportation costs goes up because you need things like snow tires in the winter and a reliable vehicle.
Okay, so the fact that Vermont is expensive, not a surprise to you. What it doesn't take into account, though, when we talk about cost of living is how much money Vermonters are making to actually cover those costs. I know that Vermont has a somewhat higher than median wage when it comes to the national average, but our cost of living is also higher. So, Jane Kolodinsky, do you have some insight you can share about how Vermont does compared to other similar places where the cost of living is high? In terms of our wages?
Yes, our wages are, as you said, our wages are relatively high and our costs are relatively high. And you also mentioned that the two ends of the country have higher costs of living. And in the end, it's really you get what you pay for. So whereas Mississippi might have the lowest cost of living, they also have the highest infant mortality rate, one of the lowest high school graduation rates, and whereas Vermont ranks number 1, 2, 3, and 4. In Vermont, we're also the state that has the fifth highest home ownership rate ranking in the whole United States. So along with home ownership comes some extra costs aside from just paying your rent.
Okay, but that still doesn't get me to the question of how do our wages compare? So we're higher than the national average when it comes to wages, but we're also more costly than the national average. So, you know, if we look at other places like Baltimore or Seattle or Providence, Rhode Island, Hartford, Connecticut. These are all places that are listed as a very similar cost of living to Burlington, Vermont. But am I right in assuming that there are also – there's the potential for higher wages for more people in those urban environments, Peter Matthews?
Yes, absolutely. People in urban environments tend to earn a little bit more, other things being equal. But I want to go back to this idea of asking ourselves how many people are able to afford that basic needs budget. And in the state of Vermont, yes, there are extraordinary amenities to being here, but less than half, for example, of all two-parent, two-child families earn what we think is the basic needs budget for a family of that size. And for single parents with one or two children, that number increases to 75 or 80%. And so that's a huge concern.
So it sounds like from your perspective, and if we take into account that the higher cost of living is not covered by similarly higher wages, is Vermont at a disadvantage?
So Vermont isn't at a disadvantage in the sense that those other things, the lower infant mortality rates, the vistas, the scenery, the natural resources, the beauty, all of those things in some sense offer some small offsetting compensating differential for those wages. It doesn't change the fact, however, that for a large number of relatively poor families, the basic needs budget is not being met.
Professor Kalaninsky, pick that up.
Yes, I would agree with that. But if you look at the poverty rates in all of the states, Vermont has a relatively low poverty rate, which means it's a complex situation that's going on. So if the costs are higher, your median wages are higher, there are still pockets of the population that struggle to make ends meet. But overall, as our Middlebury professor noted, in Vermont, there are compensating factors.
We're talking today about the cost of living in Vermont. We are, as I said, in the top 10 most expensive states in the country to live in. Other New England states rank pretty high, too. Our housing, very expensive. Heating costs, transportation, expensive, generally speaking, although heating costs a little bit more moderated in the last few years because of oil prices. But we also have some of the most generous social safety net programs and a natural beauty that many people cite as one of the main reasons they put up with high costs and that they actually get a value, get a benefit from that quality of life. So listeners, what does the cost of living mean to you when you look at, as Professor Matthews said, what it takes to feel like you're making it, that you have all of your daily needs met? Do you feel like you have the ability to do that in this state? And what would it take? What do you think would help in terms of making you feel like you can make ends meet and have the quality of life that you want? I mean, we think about things like housing. Housing costs very expensive, but what would you change? We have this natural scenic beauty, and that's part of the reason we have this aging housing stock and fewer new developments. Would you trade the natural sort of untrammeled wilderness for more cheaper housing? I want you to do that little cost-benefit analysis yourself. Tell us what you come up with. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from M in St. Albans who says, "The cost of housing and poor job availability throughout the state is killing Vermont. By and large, the only place to work in a professional career is Burlington. People want to live where they work. The cost of housing in Chittenden County is on par with Boston suburbs, but the average Burlingtonian citizen is living on half of Boston pay at best." And Mary says, "Housing and food costs are high in Vermont, especially in the orbit of Burlington, compared with New Hampshire and Maine coastal towns. And except for Burlington, tenants' rights are quite limited in this state. That results in health and heating challenges and a slightly acknowledged underclass. It's a sad condition combined with low wages and job and schedule insecurity. It's hard to get a leg up to be able to muster for a better life. It's sad and ironic in such a beautiful and apparently progressive state compared with, for example, Minnesota, which upholds more progressive practices." Jane and Peter, I'd love for both of you to comment on that because, you know, if you do look at cost of living and the sort of quality of life features that we were starting to talk about, you could move to Portland, Maine. You could move to Manchester, New Hampshire. You could move to St. Paul, Minnesota. All beautiful places with great foliage at this time of year. In many cases, sort of similar benefits in terms of the quality of life indices. But cheaper to live. You can make maybe $5,000 less and live in this to the same standard as you would in Burlington. So what do you say, Professor Matthews?
So I think I'm not sure the differences are quite that large, but I want to think a little bit about how to solve the problem, right? At one end, you're absolutely right. Housing costs are a huge issue, and that some part of solving the cost of living problem is to tackle the cost of those things we purchase. If you look at housing, transportation, childcare and healthcare, you're well over 50% of the basic needs budget for any family. So it makes sense that those are the kinds of things you want to tackle, and reformed housing policy has certainly got to be part of the story. Better access to transportation for rural Vermonters has got to be part of the story. Cheaper health insurance has got to be part of the story. But another part of the story has to be ways of increasing wages of Vermonters so that, in fact, even if those costs don't change very much, those basic needs become more affordable.
All right. So do you have thoughts on how to do that?
So absolutely. Education has got to be part of the story, right? We know that there's a strong link between education and wages and income. But other things are part of the story, too. We know that institutional factors matter a great deal when we think about income, everything from job protection to minimum wage policy to policies that have the effect of improving the bargaining position of workers. One of the things to remember, and one of the things that struck me about the Castleton survey, was that inequality was quite far down the list of concerns of Vermonters. But some part of the problem is that income has been growing relatively quickly in Vermont, but the distribution of that income has been relatively uneven. And so the median Vermont household is not a lot better off than it was some time ago. That's something that has to change, too.
Professor Kolodinsky, I want to get you in here, but just very briefly, Peter Matthews first, you know, that idea of what is the most pressing issue for Vermont and that inequality ranks fairly low. If I'm in a position where I'm worried about, you know, whether or not I'm going to be able to make ends meet or pay for my car registration or get my kid taken care of at daycare, I feel like I'd be less worried about thinking about inequality as sort of a general problem and more worried about, you know, wages, economy, jobs in my particular situation.
So I think you're right at the level of surface. I think that if you're struggling to make ends meet, you're not thinking about the deep structural solution to the problem. But some part of the long-term solution has to be a change in income distribution.
Professor Kolodinsky?
Well, it's interesting that the Castleton poll has found that economics is first. At the Center for Rural Studies, we've been doing the Vermonter poll for 35 years. And the top five issues, when you just ask people off the top of their head, what are the top five issues? Doesn't matter if it's recessionary time or boom time. Economics is always in the top three. It's just salient on our minds. We heard that perhaps wages is one way to tackle the issue. And in fact, starting in January, Vermont will have one of the highest minimum wages in the entire country. And you see that that's a positive for citizens, and yet you see a lot of pushback from business saying, I can't stay in business. So it's not just increasing wages. It's not just decreasing the cost of things. It's a very complicated situation. And even in Vermont, if you look at the cost of living index and you look deeper, what you find is it is only based on Chittenden County and even Burlington and South Burlington, because these are metro areas. And Vermont, indeed, is a very rural town.
So Or
Vermont is a very rural state. And while we have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the entire country, when you look across Vermont, you can find extremely high unemployment rates in the most rural areas. So in some ways, the cost of living index is a little bit misleading because it really only includes Burlington and South Burlington.
We are talking about cost of living, and Peter Matthews, I'll get you back in here. We've got to take a quick break, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that breakdown. What's the difference when we do look more sort of granularly at the state, difference between Chittenden County and other parts of the state? We've got a note from Mark who says, you know, it's sometimes said with sarcasm, there's Chittenden County and then there's Vermont. So Mark wants to know, what is that breakdown between Chittenden County cost of living with that high housing cost and other parts of the state? We're going to get into that a little bit. We're also going to take some of your calls. You're weighing in on what you think about the cost of living in Vermont, what it actually means to you. If you'd like to join our callers and our emailers, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we are talking about Vermont's cost of living with Peter Matthews, chair of the Economics Department at Middlebury College, and Jane Kolodinsky, chair of UVM's Department of Community Development and Applied Economics. She's also director of UVM's Center for Rural Studies. And if you have a question or you want to weigh in on what you think of the cost of living in Vermont, what that means to you, and what you think would make a difference in making quality of life and cost of life better, more manageable for you, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Richard emailed in to say, yes, cost of living in Vermont is high. We relocated to Vermont several years ago from the Pacific Riviera on the coast of Southern California. I didn't do the research on these costs. I just assumed California was far more expensive than Vermont. I was wrong, Richard says. Although we find Vermont beautiful, the cost of living is actually higher in Vermont, and we have recently considered a move to New York, Connecticut, or Massachusetts, where we are finding costs more favorable. Interesting, California, if you look at those cost of living indices, I think California is higher than Vermont, but certainly individual experiences are going to differ depending on what your job is, what your housing situation is, whether or not you have kids. Let's get a call in here from Steve, who's on the line with us from Winooski. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I was glad to hear one of your guests bring up the cost of insurance. Personally, I'm relatively well off, but with the Affordable Care Act coming out and finding the Vermont premiums being near the highest in the nation, that and my heating bill really make me kind of live like a poor middle class. It's a strange dynamic where I'm making more than enough for any subsidies. And so the premiums in the $500 and $600 a month range are really, really almost too much to bear. So the question for me isn't whether or not to keep the insurance. It's whether to keep the insurance or keep my place above 55 degrees in the winter. And it's just kind of a catch-22 that definitely sways me to look towards leaving the state soon, along with my girlfriend who just graduated and is having a hard time finding a job in the area.
Steve, thanks for your perspective. I appreciate that and really puts a fine point on that question of healthcare and costs of healthcare, even for people who do have insurance. Let's get Mary Ellen in here from Putney. Hi, Mary Ellen. Your thoughts?
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call. Comments. I am a nurse and have worked as a nurse for 25 years, but I have not worked in Vermont because the wages are so low that it's worth it for me to drive 35 or 40 minutes to get across the state line into Massachusetts where it doubles my wage. And just earned a master's degree and having the same issue. I live in the Brattleboro area and finding a job that pays me what I consider a reasonable wage, given my experience and my education, is impossible.
But Mary Ellen, why stay in Putney? Why not leave the state altogether if you can't even work here?
Well, just as you folks have noted, I love all the benefits of small-town rural living. It is what I choose, and I know it's a conscious choice to have the difficulties, the relative difficulties that I have, but you can't keep the scenery. And at some point, I think for a lot of people, especially people who do have an education and a relatively easy ability to move to get a better level of employment, those people leave the state. And I'm considering it now, and that will make me very sad to choose to do so.
Mary Ellen, yeah.
The cost of electricity.
Yeah, I hear you. Thank you. That's really helpful to hear your perspective on that. I want to get one more call in, and then Peter Matthews will come back to you. Matt's calling in from Holland. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. My opinion on the income problem is that people just don't want to work like they used to back, way back when people weren't afraid to get their hands dirty and put in 50, 60 hours in a week to make a living.
Yeah, Matt, I appreciate that. Hear what you're saying there, too. Peter Matthews, what are you hearing and where do you want to jump in on this?
So I think there are a couple of places I'd like to jump in. One is to comment a little bit on Janet's quite justifiable concern on data on rural versus urban Vermont. We do have some data on rural Vermont. There is some county-level data. And in fact, I had students work on a question of what the basic needs budgets would look like in Addison County, which is a largely rural county. And As you would expect, the basic needs budgets are 15 or 20% lower than they are in Chittenden County. Chittenden County, by the way, in terms of basic needs budget, looks about as expensive as Los Angeles County. So basic needs budgets are smaller in rural Vermont. On the other hand, as one of the callers and I think Janet noted, employment opportunities are sometimes not as good. And we come back to this question of, yes, the cost of living may be lower, but how many people can afford that cost? Mary Ellen's concern with wages is well placed. We have to pursue policies that not only have the effect of reducing the cost of living in Vermont, including health insurance, Steve's concern, but also increasing wages. The two of them together, I think, are an important part of any solution to this problem.
Professor Kolodinsky?
Yes, I noted that one caller said that they might be considering Connecticut or Rhode Island. And if you look at the overall cost of living rankings, they're actually more expensive than the cost of living in Vermont.
So, but again, what about wages?
But each individual's experience is very different. We had a caller say that they were able to sort of play the system. I can work in Massachusetts and I can live in Vermont, and that helps me. Whereas if you were living in Massachusetts, your cost of living would be higher. It's a very tricky balancing act that also begins to bring politics in, as in, do you want higher minimum wages? Do you want health care to be required to be provided by employers? And so you start to get that supply and demand. And as a very small state, one of the smallest in the nation, you have fewer people to spread those public costs on, the cost of education, some of the costs of healthcare, the cost of keeping roads and bridges open. Those public costs are spread out over a fewer number of people, which means each individual ends up paying more.
Jane, you were talking earlier as well about that difference between and among different parts of the state, and Peter Matthews was picking up on that a little bit. But can you go deeper into that as well? Because, housing is going to be cheaper in many parts of the state outside of Chittenden County, but transportation costs may be higher and wages are lower. So how do we sort of balance all that out?
Yeah, that's a tricky question, and it's one, I think, for community development. In Vermont, if you were to ask residents where they would prefer to live, in a compact community with a lot of housing or in a rural area with 2 acres of land, the average Vermonter says, I would like to live on those outskirts in the rural areas with my own amount of land. If that's where you prefer to live, unfortunately, some of those additional costs, such as transportation, come into play. So unless you're willing to do compact urban development to retain the rural nature of Vermont, which really drives our economy, it's give and take.
When you say unless you're willing, do you mean unless communities and municipal governments are willing or individuals? Because then we're getting into this idea of agency. You know, if you don't have a great job, but maybe you have a house that's paid for, or you have a family structure that is supportive to you in a place that's very rural where you live, you may not feel like you have a lot of ability to up and move to somewhere where you can walk to work and avoid those transportation costs. And maybe you don't feel like you could get a job in that sort of saturated Burlington environment.
Right. And what you're talking about in some sense is house rich and resource poor, in that you are a homeowner, but yet you are still faced with limited resources. I think one of the solutions is to get communities involved in government and become local agents. And indeed, in Vermont, that is something we do very well. Our government's accessible. Communities still have a sense of community. And so that in when we're talking about regional planning, urban planning, rural planning, consumers should and the community should have a voice in those plans.
Let's go to Susan calling in from Tynmouth. Hi, Susan. Your thoughts. Susan, you there? All right, we'll see if we can come back to Susan. How about Donna in South Burlington? Hi, Donna, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One of your guests just touched just now on the fact that government and school costs are divided amongst fewer citizens in Vermont because just of the size of the community. I also wanted to question about the size of the towns and cities in the Northeast in particular are quite a bit smaller. I grew up in Pennsylvania and, you know, had relatives in the Midwest, and they always pointed out it's just like, you know, that their cities are so much larger and included more people, so that our towns and cities here are quite small. And, you know, aren't we by having such small towns, you know, really having to have higher costs per person for government and schools?
Donna, thanks for your call. Yeah, you can actually check that out in a really tangible way if you want to go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. We have a couple of the tools that we've been using in preparing for the show to look at these different cost of living indices, and one from CNN Money where you can plug in where you live and pick your salary. They sort of start with a salary of $50,000, and then you can plug in where you think you might want to live instead of Vermont and see how much it would cost to live there. But the only option you have for I live in Vermont is Burlington, Chittenden County. Whereas, you know, if you look at moving to somewhere in New York, you've got two choices in New York City. You've got Albany, you've got Buffalo, you've got Dutchess County. So you've got all these other options. But in Vermont or in Maine, you get one place, the big city, to suggest where you live. What do you think about that, Peter Matthews, that idea of our small towns really shouldering a burden because of just their small population?
So it's absolutely true that small towns aren't able to realize some of the economies of scale that larger towns might realize. On the other hand, I don't think that the response here is for small towns to kind of shrug their shoulders in despair and say there's really not much we can do. So I want to come back to a particular example, which is that even small towns face interesting transportation challenges, right? Everyone has pointed to the issue of transportation as being an important driver of cost of living in Vermont, and that's unambiguously the case. For many rural Vermonters, a car is an absolute necessity, and that's not true, for example, for people in large cities like New York. That said, there are opportunities for building public infrastructure, public transportation in even small towns. Small towns like Middlebury have reasonably reliable public transportation, and that's a big part of thinking about solutions to transportation costs and frankly thinking about cost of living. So yes, small towns are a little bit more expensive than big towns, other things being equal, but that doesn't mean that small towns can't be creative and can't be innovative in ways that they think about addressing these problems.
Michelle is calling in from Castleton. Hey, Michelle, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are touching on the issue before that the whole subject that wage increases are directly correlating to education. And I think we really at some point need to, you know, make a decision to really get these wages up. My husband and I have lived in the state. We've worked at our jobs for 11 and 7 years. We are educated. We got a graduate from Castleton State College. But our wages don't go up. It's still a very top-tier structure system where VPs of our companies are making very, very profitable wages, and us at the lower levels don't seem to find room to gain and don't find an increase in our wage. Yet we have groceries, we have daycare, we have heating costs, we have all these things happening, and I really think we just need to get these companies that are operating in Vermont to get the wages up and make a life livable for us here.
Michelle, so would you support, for example, a higher minimum wage in the state? Would you support mandatory health care by employers? I mean, you see some of those proposals put out there, and then you can see pushback from employers who say, I can't afford to do that for my employees, whether I want to or not. So what's your perspective as somebody who's working and trying to make ends meet?
I think if they can pay their VP $300,000 a year for a position, they might be able to help increase their wages on the bottom line and cut that back.
Point taken.
I just think we're in a position where these companies, VPs, are so profitable and making such that top 1% versus the other percent scenario. They need to find a minimum. You know, we're paying for our health care costs going up through private insurance. You know, we're taking that onto our shoulders, and we're just not getting anywhere. And there's no room really for growth in that area either. So,
yeah, Michelle, thanks. That's an interesting perspective that you bring to the table. Thank you for sharing it with us. And Bud emailed in to say, you think cost of living is bad in Vermont? Look, it's all relative. Perhaps my views are skewed since I moved here with my fiance from New Jersey. Bud says, please don't hold it against me. But we couldn't be happier. Susan in Tynemouth is back. Hey, Susan, do we have you on the line now?
Yes, I just wanted to mention that our town, and perhaps in others as well, I haven't done the research, we have quite a mixed income town, a very rich combination of different people with different ideas who listen to each other most of the time. And some of the people who most value the open land, there's about 5,000 acres or more in Tynemouth of huntable land, and they value it for hunting. And they go out and get their deer and another deer whenever they can, and down in it, into the freezer it goes, still with all in all the legal constraints.
But Susan, I hear what you're saying. So there's sort of different ideas of valuing landscape, valuing different sort of priorities and different ways to make the landscape work for you. We're short on time. Jane Kolodinsky, I'd love to know what you're thinking about here as we sort of wrap up this discussion.
Well, as we wrap up, I think I'd like the listeners to think about the fact that it's not only the cost side of the equation, that there's also the quality of life side of the equation. And you could pick up and move to another place that has a lower cost of living according to the list, but you might end up living with 20,000 of your closest friends or not. And you might face other obstacles in terms of transportation and utilities that you don't face in Vermont. So they're really the trade-offs. And for people who have a choice, they should make that choice. And for people who don't, we really do have to get together to make things better for the citizens.
That's Jane Kolodinsky. She's chair of UVM's Department of Community Development and Applied Economics and director of UVM's Center for Rural Studies. And we've also been talking with Peter Matthews, chair of the Economics Department at Middlebury College. Thanks very much to both of you for being part of this discussion.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for having me.
Coming up, 5 communities in Vermont have been getting some special help in preparing for another Irene-like flood event. We'll hear about the Vermont Economic Resiliency Initiative next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermonters have learned a lot about flood resiliency in the 4 years since Tropical Storm Irene. Some of that knowledge is captured in the final report of the Vermont Economic Resiliency Initiative. Over the last 2 years, multiple agencies have been working together to look at how individual towns can think about the economic impacts of flood damage and the value in mitigating it. 5 pilot communities were studied, and they've been getting assistance with policy changes, infrastructure improvements, property buyouts, and other strategies to reduce the impact of flooding. Noelle McKay is the Commissioner of Housing and Community Development. She says the Vermont Economic Resiliency Initiative started with the premise that flooding can be predicted better than other natural disasters, and that future floods are inevitable.
In the past, in Vermont, almost every year we've had some major flood somewhere. And I think a lot of times when we're looking at river corridors and protecting them and kind of figuring out where the flooding occurs, we don't actually think of the economics of the damage. And so protecting a floodway that will make sure that that links to keeping a road open so people, employees, goods and services can move, as well as keeping businesses open, is just better for everyone. And so this is what we really did as a team. We looked across the state and we provided every community with a ranking of economic activity, infrastructure vulnerability, and flooding. And then we looked at the 30, kind of top 32, and we got down to 5 looking at, we wanted to have a mix of size and scale of communities. We wanted to have an agricultural community. We wanted to have a recreational community and some downtowns. So we chose Barry City, Barrytown, Brattleboro, Brandon, Enosburg, and Woodstock.
And what did you do with those 5 communities? Because you didn't just look at their flood risk. You actually worked with them to identify how to come up with a plan and what they needed to do to make sure that they were prepared for flooding.
So we started out with just holding a community forum. What have you done? What are the risks? What are we missing? What do we need to look at? And we had a team of river scientists and engineers that went out, walked the river, looked at where the damage was, and came up with very specific recommendations, as I said. And then we went back to the community and said, did we get it right? And which ones would you suggest that the community works with first? And then after that, because we have a commitment, long-term commitment, to making sure that we reduce risks and reduce costs, we went and started talking to our sister agencies, philanthropic organizations, other nonprofits, and said, how can we help these communities implement these recommendations? And also, how can other communities? So some of these buckets, like doing buyouts on vulnerable properties. We had a big slug of money after Irene for that, but ongoing we might not. So is there another funding source, or are there another ways that we can be creative about if someone has a buyout opportunity and they can create a floodplain, how do we help a community do that?
Can you pick one of those 5 communities and drill down a little bit? Give me an example of what their issues were and how you worked with them.
Sure. So I think Barry City, Barrytown is a great example. their downtown, obviously, floods. And we heard from the community members, you know, I've lived there for 40 years. In the last 10 years, my basement's flooding every year. And, you know, in these neighborhoods, you know, mixed income, but they're really affordable homes. And specifically in that area, we suggested that they, policy-wise, that the communities get together, so Berry City, Berry Town, Plainfield, and work on a stormwater management and debris plan. We suggested that they make sure that they all have the new Agency of Transportation road and bridges standards and put those in place. But then we also suggested that they look at buying out about 30 properties in the Gunnersbrook area, creating some floodplain that would allow debris to settle there, not flood the rest of the downtown and the rest of the neighborhood. As luck would have it or not, we had flooding in July. It was exactly in the Gunnersbrook study area. And both the Mayor Lauzon and the town manager, Steve McKenzie, were very involved and appreciative of the study and were planning on moving it forward. But this just kind of, it moved to the top of the list faster. So they are now looking at grant applications for three of the buyouts, kind of on a smaller scale. Going to try to create some floodplain. And they're working on a grant with the other towns for a stormwater management plan. Steve has started a new email listserv to kind of let the communities know if a storm is coming, what they're doing to prepare, just to let them know. So people feel safe and they know what to do. So in the short term, it's really about safety. And the long term, they're really looking at about reducing the ongoing costs of recovery.
Do you see the issues there sort of scaling to the rest of the state? You mentioned that you looked for five communities that have had different characteristics. Mm-hmm. But are the issues these communities face the same, or does each community in Vermont have a different population, a different infrastructure, a different geography, and a different set of problems?
Each of those five had similar buckets. So flood-proofing buildings, upgrading infrastructure, protecting floodplains or restoring floodplains, and also looking at public safety and buyouts. So all of them had that, and I think any community could look at those issues. The other thing that was really interesting is many of those communities had had some kind of river study, and a lot of conservation commissions around the state have these kind of studies that really tell where you should be preserving wetlands, where you should be preserving floodplain. And that's a really good place, information that's already out there that every community could start with.
You have some specific recommendations that you'll be working with these five communities on implementing over the next few years. Can you list a couple of them?
So the ones that we talked about in Barrie, Woodstock has some road and bridge and culvert. Brattleboro is looking at an 8-acre piece of land that they want to preserve and create a floodplain. And Enosburg, you know, they're a dairy community, and so we'll probably be looking at them to help with continuity of operations for farms and some floodproofing for their businesses.
From what you're hearing from these five communities and from the larger 32 communities that you looked at that are prone to flooding, what's the biggest hurdle for them? I mean, money's always an issue, but
money's always
is
an
that
issue.
The biggest barrier?
I think it's one of the biggest barriers. I think what really is heartening is when you go out into communities, they understand this stuff. They understand that, you know, the town of Brandon, they have a really intact upland forest from their downtown. They realize that that's really important for them to maintain that so the flooding doesn't increase downtown. People understand how those pieces work, which is really great. So we've got a good baseline understanding. We've got great partnerships here in the state. I think sometimes the buckets of money that come in after a flood just aren't that flexible. And I think we even saw that. We had some experts come in post-Irene, right after Irene, and talked about what their states had done. And we couldn't do some of the same things with, for example, the community development block grant money that came. You know, the federal government kind of ratchets it and tweaks it and puts a lot of rules for very good reasons, but it really limits our flexibility. And so I think the other thing we're looking at, and the Institute for Sustainable Communities has a resilience network that are going to try to bring together on some of these issues, is how do we find more flexible funding sources that can help with the match? Because even if, you know, so we pay for 75, that 25% to do a buyout is a lot of money. So I think it is money, but it's flexible money that we need. And, you know, that's why we've reached out to the philanthropic community, which have been just a godsend here and such great partners. But how do we do that? And how do we make sure that the money is there when we need it?
When you released the final report of the Vermont Economic Resiliency Initiative, it came along with, at least in the press release, a pretty provocative headline, which was something like the 32 most vulnerable communities in Vermont for flooding. So
that figured that would get your attention.
Right, exactly. But that makes it sound like, oh, no, we are not in any better shape than we were 4 years ago when Irene hit. Is that true? Is that the perspective that you have?
I think we are better prepared and we know where our vulnerabilities are. I think what this report looks at is really the economics of it. You know, we looked at communities that had single employers or single employers for a whole region. And if those employers are cut off, then we're really in trouble. So we really wanted people to continue. We want to continue to keep this in people's minds because I have heard, oh, Irene was 4 years ago. And I think for someone that has gotten the emergency management bug, preparedness pays off. Those people, those communities, those businesses that are prepared, have thought through the issues, have practiced, they just come out the other side faster and stronger. And that's really what we're trying to keep in people's minds.
Noelle McKay is the Commissioner of Housing and Community Development. She spoke with us about the final report just issued by the Vermont Economic Resiliency Initiative, which seeks to help businesses and towns work together with the state and federal government to mitigate the impact of future flooding. The five pilot towns in the project that she was talking about were Berry City and Town, Brandon, Brattleboro, Enosburg Village and Town, and Woodstock. And you can read the full report online. Go to vpr.net/Vermont Edition. About three quarters of the state is forest land. So who's making sure all of those trees are healthy and being treated fairly? Hundreds of volunteer tree stewards who take the stewardship of the Urban Landscape Tree Steward Program. They advocate for the trees, kind of like the Loraxes of Vermont. We walked the beat with one of them, Sue Lovering, as she inspected trees on Main Street in Johnson.
This is a honey locust tree. It was planted 2 years ago for Johnson's Main Street project, in which they put 43 new trees in. It's planted in the sidewalk with grates, which has presented a little bit of a logistical problem when it comes to mulching and weeding. Weeds come through a grate, mulch does not. This tree and the one next to it are not doing very well. Part of the reason for that, we feel, is that it's in front of a restaurant, and we pulled 200 cigarette butts out of three trees on this little patch right here this summer. Cigarette butts are full of toxins. They leach into the soil. Every time this tree gets rain, you get more toxins leached in, and the tree sucks it up. This tree in particular is at risk because it's planted in a very small pit, 3.5 by 3.5 feet by about 5 feet deep. I've loved trees and nature since my earliest memories. I own a bunch of trees. And the thought of helping trees, planting more trees, just brings me great joy. As far as our urban trees go, the trees that we have planted in the Village Rights of Way and on Main Street, we keep them healthy, prune them, mulch them, fertilize them, make sure if something gets broken, we take care of it. This one we haven't gotten to yet this year, but this was volcano mulched when it was planted. And you can see that the ground is too high around the base of it. It's one of the leading causes of tree death is volcano mulch. You see it all the time in people's trees. What it means is when you mulch your tree, you pile the mulch up around the tree base a few inches, and it's enough to destroy the bark and let insects and disease in around the base of the tree. And it's a slow killer when it happens. So this is another autumn blaze. But this tree is extremely interesting. This is a very old maple. It was planted by our tree warden's grandfather, and it's one of the original Main Street trees on Johnson. Johnson used to be, this street, Main Street, used to be lined with old maples like that. They were out here somewhere. There are old postcard shots of, you know, cars on dirt roads with these huge, beautiful maples just arching over the road. I would so love to see that here again. One of our goals here on the tree board is to get those trees back again. We have a human-sized emerald ash borer costume that's grown locally famous. We call it the big bug. I dress up in it on occasion. Actually, it belongs to the state, and other people do too. But, you know, we wear it in parades and functions and things like that, just to get people to ask, what is that? And then we point them over to our display tent where they pick up information and talk to somebody. We did an ash inventory on the rights of way. We found 2,470 ash trees in 46 miles of road. That did not include the two state highways that run through this town. So ash is a big problem. There's a lot of it in Vermont, and it really needs to be addressed preemptively, proactively. There goes a truck full of ash now. Someone's preemptively cutting.
Sue Lovering is a graduate of the Soul Tree Steward Program. She also serves on the Johnson Conservation Commission and Tree Board. The annual Tree Stewards Conference is this Saturday in Bristol. And that piece was produced by VPR's Rick Singeri. That's it for today. Tomorrow, Congressman Peter Welch joins us. We'll talk about Syria, gun laws, congressional leadership, and more. You can send your questions for Congressman Welch to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.